Hello, sisters. It's Kia, and I wanted to say thank you for coming on this journey with me. The next episode is the season 5 premiere, and I'm really excited to share it with you. It's Alicia's episode. She's an incredible author, and she has had a very interesting experience serving in the National Guard. So I'm so excited to have her story here for you. And I want to say thank you to everyone who has been supporting the show, sharing the episodes, listening in every week, and every time I post one, and supporting through actual donations during a pandemic. That is absolutely beyond me. But it is an honor and a privilege to share these stories and have our stories be heard. So thank you for sharing with me and donating and supporting. And if you would like to start doing that, the information is in the description box of the show, as well as how to connect with me directly and how to get involved with some of that activism that I do as a female veteran and I support. So all of that information is in the description box or the show notes of each and every episode. And thank you, really. And for those of you who have been coming to the workshops that I've been doing with the Barbara Giordano Foundation, I really appreciate your presence and your support. I love you guys. Stay tuned for the season 5 premiere of the Female Veterans Podcast. Hello, beautiful. And what I really want to know is, what is good in your life today? I'm Kia, and this is another episode of the Female Veterans Podcast. Today, I have with me Alicia. She is incredibly creative, a published author, and she is my very first full National Guard veteran who has served this country. Now, I have had National Guard women before, but they usually have gone to the Army and become veterans from there. This is my very first Army National Guard vet, and I'm super excited to have her on the show. Welcome, Alicia.
Thank you, Kia, for having me. I'm so excited to be on the podcast, and I've been looking forward to it for a while. I will say I started listening recently, and that really helped me understand what it was about. And I was so looking forward to being a part of it. And it's also helped me on my journey as a female veteran. So that's always good. Full circle here.
Oh my gosh, I'm so honored to hear that. So I want to jump right into it because I have so many questions for you. Tell me now, why did you join the military?
I joined the military because at the time, it was before I was 17, and I was in high school with braces on my teeth. And I looked at my sister had actually went to some sort of a 2 or 3 day camp with the Iowa National Guard, and she rappelled off a tower and was like, "This is the greatest thing ever." And it was to try to promote people for recruiting. And she loved it so much, and she learned a lot. And I was a creative. I was a editor of my high school newspaper. I was always a writer. And so I was like, well, I can do that. And a lot of people said, well, you're not really the type. You're more, you know, I had went and saw Gloria Steinem and Bob Woodward like at the university. And I was watching all these famous journalists from around the world. And I had always had that in me. But the guard was like, a lot of people told me, I don't think you would be fit for that. And that just, you know, pushes me and this thing in me that's like, wait, what? Cause like I'm 17 and I have a lot of the world I want to see. And a lot of the issues of getting a job in journalism is you need experience. So they usually hire people that have a lot of experience. Well, how do you get experience? You have to go out and have a job. So I thought, like, if I don't have the experience, how am I going to get a job? And if I wanted, you know, it just like, it's kind of like a catch 22. So me and a friend wanted to join together and she was like, oh, I'm going to be a nurse. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to be, but I know that I want this challenge and I want to see the world. And so at 17 in June of 2001, I joined. And you can join at 17 as long as your parents sign. So I remember like practicing the duck walk and like all this stuff. And I'm like, I'm really tall. So that was a hard thing for me. Like I remember sweating it out, like trying to see if I was going to be able to make it. But that first year, actually, I didn't go to basic right away. So they allow you to serve while you get ready for basic training while you're in high school. So I did that. And my grandpa was in the Army and he was in World War II and the Korean conflict.
Wow.
So I have military in my family. I claim him first because I'm Army, but I have like a ton of cousins and uncles in the Navy. And I know you're Navy.
Yeah, I'm a Navy girl.
I only do jokes about the Navy. So I mean, it's pretty much just like, you know, to all the guys, like, why would you choose to be on a ship for that long? Like, what are you guys going on? Like, it was just this, we have this big rivalry, but I would say that my grandpa, I was always proud of him and I didn't get to meet him. So there was a lot of things to sum it up. I wanted a challenge. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to do the job before I had any of the credentials to do it. And the recruiter, I had a really good recruiter. He passed last year, Sergeant Gertz, and he was amazing because he made sure I got the job I wanted, which was a public affairs specialist. So I was a journalist for the Army. And it was an incredible opportunity for me to get college money because I wanted to go to a university. And I have two sisters, and that means they're all 2 years apart. It's not going to happen with all that. There's no money coming in that way to pay for college. And so all of those things combined were really my reasoning. And it sounded like a great opportunity. So I took it.
Wow. I mean, I love your reasons. And the idea that because you were studying journalism in high school, and then you got to be a journalist in the Army, that's so incredible. Like, what a way to like create a firm foundation. I mean, I always say my mom wanted me to go to the military to set a foundation for my life. And that appears to me to be exactly what you did. And I love how the fact that people told you you wouldn't be a fit for, I'm like that too. I think many of us that join are like that. Oh, you don't think I'm a fit for it? Let me show you.
It's my Achilles heel. If you told me no, it's going to be like, okay, so I'm going to definitely try to do it. Or anytime someone tries to put you in a corner, you know, we're going to climb our way out. And anyone who joins, I mean, at the time, I remember them telling me like one out of every 11 people that walked in the recruiter's office actually got in because it was before September 11th. So it was a big deal to get in and to get the job you wanted and to have all of the test you had to take. I had to be interviewed to get that job. I remember being so green, like, well, I saw Gloria Steinem. So like, isn't that enough? I mean, I want to be a journalist. But like, I think if I look back on those leaders, it was, you know, they saw something in me because a lot of people transition from other roles to be a journalist, but to start from the very beginning and have that, they'd never had that in the unit where you immediately just started from like an E1. And
so you had to wait to go to basic. So when you finally did go to basic, what was it like for you?
You know, they had this program where they had like specialists pretend to be drill sergeants, which was hilarious. And in hindsight, but they would get you ready. So when I would go to drill weekends, I would actually go to part of it with my unit. And then I would go part of it to this like practice. And I think that actually helped me understand what to expect. I met the Adjutant General of Iowa when I was like a private, and I had no idea he was in civilian clothes. And so I went in there and I was like, you really need to get this story done. And it was like an Air Force because we have both. And I'm like, I don't know. No one's answering the phone. So he was actually in his office and he was like, let me pick up the phone for you and help you. And so the Adjutant General of Iowa like immediately helped me. And I had no idea about rank or structure or any of these things. And so looking back on that, like basic training was I had that respect because I had absolutely learned, and that general was amazing and awesome. I had to watch some, you know, fighter jet videos after that because he took a special interest in my career, because no private just rolls up to the general. It's like, I need this story. I mean, we got to publish in like a month or something. But that was like a really good opportunity to get the respect built for what you're about ready to do. And it gave me some time to get ready for push-ups and all the other stuff. And so basic training to me was a really important part of my, I would say, career, because it takes you from everything that you think is important, and then you have zero control. You are government property. And all of a sudden, you're like, this is really real. This is real. And I can't sleep when I want. And I got to get up and I got to do fire guard, and I'm passing out from exhaustion. Like, I became an old lady in basic training. Like, let's roll those covers up at 7 p.m. Right. And like, there is nothing better. But the best part about basic training was, you know, I come from a small town in Missouri, and then I grew up in my education in Iowa. And so now I got to see the world through all the people that I live with in my room. So from all walks of life, from all ethnicities, like my whole room was just like a melting pot of what the military really is. It's, you know, 47% are not white. And so now I have someone from Puerto Rico. My battle buddy is from Texas and she's Latina. And then I have someone from Chicago, and then someone who's Mormon from Utah. So like our whole group, our room was just every state I wanted to see. And then one of them was Navajo. And she was like, you're the first white person I've liked. And I was like, I love that for you. Right. Like, for me too. It was
so funny.
It was like those characters, in a way, like those people have shaped my whole military career, because that's the beautiful part about it, is you're going through one of the hardest things you've went to at that point in your life. And you're going through it with perfect strangers who were brought up totally differently than you. And you're in it together. You're in it together. And I just felt like basic training was for me. I could actually learn from all of them around me. And then I would say, okay, well, I don't think I can do that. Like, rappelling was a big thing for me, or push-ups were really hard for me, actually, because I'm really tall. So when I do, and I'm gesturing now, that doesn't help. But if I do a regular push-up, I was doing it wrong. And so my drill sergeant had me meet every single night after chow and do like a wide-armed push-up to get my body to where I would be able to pass. So I wasn't in shape or ready like a typical, maybe a guy that's, you know, just coming off of football practice. It was a big thing for me. And at every step of the way, I mean, my battle buddy, I don't know that everybody in all the branches had that, but a battle buddy is someone who you're accountable to, and they are with you all the time. It's 24/7. That was the most beautiful relationship that you can have in the military. I think whether it's your basic training battle or your AIT advanced training, or even after, you are with someone who is going to take care of you, and you start to be accountable for them and also worry about them. And I felt like the military was very smart about that. It's something that can shape you as a leader, as a person, that it's not all about you anymore. Guess what? If you're wrong, they're all wrong. And if you're wrong and your battle buddy is wrong, it's like you're in it together. You're doing push-ups together. I had the best battle buddies. I did. That relationship really was an inspiration for my book that we'll talk about later. And that battle buddy friendship has never been written out. I've never seen it in fiction for female veterans. I hear a lot of, you know, male veterans, they have Band of Brothers and Jarhead and all these things that people can align themselves to about military service, but we're the same. And that relationship is, I mean, you go through everything together, and it's almost like family, but even more. So I have sisters, and you tell each other the truth, and you're mean, and you'd say the thing that you can't say to a friend. So people are like, oh, you had an army friend. No. That's the person that's going to pull you back and say, no, you're wrong, or nope, you shouldn't be doing that. or where were you at last night? Or it's the whole thing, right? So they are accountable to you. And if your battle is in the wrong, like I said before, it's something that the army can help shape both of you together. And I felt like that was such an important foundation. Yes, basic was all the things that are in the army basic training in what, 2002, fire ant, you know, carrying, I mean, we actually got in trouble and I put that part in a narrative in my book, but it was like me and my battle buddy got in trouble together a lot. And so I know that relationships with a drill sergeant, and I'm like 5'10" and she's like 5 foot nothing. Right. And so the things we would be like crossing our eyes and doing push-ups while we would get in trouble. Okay. We're going to do push-ups, cross our eyes and get in trouble. And it really like was a foundational part to me in my career. And we stayed in touch after, and I went and visited her in Texas, and my AIT battle buddy. That was even just a different experience when you go through training. But yeah, so that's kind of how I summed up basic, was the relationships I built.
That's beautiful, because I really identify with that. So we didn't have battle buddies when I went through basic in the Navy. So we were in an open bay room with like 100 racks in your locker. So we were all battle buddies, the lot of us. And we got in trouble together. We got beat together, cycled, all of that. We got in trouble together. But I really closely identify with what you're saying, because in that room, there was everyone. Every race, color, creed, religion, everything was there. Yep. And so I remember we would have time on Sundays where we could, after church and all of that, where we could actually hang out a bit. And we would all hang out with each other. Sometimes we'd be doing trades of who did what best for the uniform, right? And helping each other out. And we would be talking and just talking about everything. And it would be such an interesting experience to hear the perspective of someone from across the country from you, or from down south, because I'm from the Northeast. So to hear someone else and how they grew up and their stories was, to me, it was the stories and the perspectives that really built that sisterhood, so that at the end of that 8 weeks, it was almost traumatic to say goodbye to these girls, yeah, to these women, you know? So fortunately, some of them moved with me to A school, which is what AIT is for you guys,
yep,
for A school for us. And I went to a hospital corps school. Some of them went to A school on the other side of our base, which was for all the other jobs on the ship, right? Other than medical. And then some of them left, you know, they got their orders to other schools on other bases. And some of them went to TPU until they got their orders. So we got to spend a little bit more time together before we parted ways. But those relationships, it's kind of like you were saying, I love what you said about like band of brothers and stuff like that, because I don't think that the world at large really understands we as women who serve have those same bonds, but it's different because we're women. So we have that from the female perspective and how our emotions work and how we connect, but it is equally as powerful as those stories.
Yeah.
They need to be told.
They do. I think about, you know, I have my own like truth moments. We had, I don't know if you guys had like those flashlights, and they were like standard issue. Everybody needs your flashlight. And they had like those red lenses, and we would have our red flashlight special, like we were TLC instead of the red. It was like, we would have like the greatest, like we would have Skittles that we would steal, which you can't have Skittles in basic. So they would like take all the candy when you had an MRE in the field. So we would like store them in our sports bras. And then, so I can remember me and my battle sitting at like 3 a.m. or in the bathroom going to eat these Skittles. We pull them out and they're just like a sheet all stuck together from all the sweat that had melted them completely. Or then I'm like, listen, we can't have unibrows. So like we would have to wait until in the night and like go into the bathroom and hide. And then just like even showers, you know, they're like rushing you through. Mm-hmm. And it's like a big joke to be like, no, you're going to take a 10-second shower or whatever. So you're just like in there and it's so close, like family, like a relationship. And you, when your family comes on graduation, you want to be like, no, 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 these are my people. Like, this is my group. Like, this is, these people are everything. You're trying to show them off to your family because they've heard all your stories, you know, all your, you know, kind of siblings and all that through the stuff that you're talking about on Sundays where you're talking. And that was just so huge to me because you really can't represent it to anyone that's not in it. And then when you write about it, you're like, okay, this will give them a flavor. But I really feel like Sisters in Uniform is a bond that's like, can never be broken. They could call me up tomorrow and it would be like no time had passed. And that's almost 20 years ago, right? But it doesn't matter because you went through the hell with them. You embraced the suck of the military together.
Embrace the suck. Like, I love it.
It's like it never, they can't get you anymore, you know, because you're like, no, I think I know. And even just meeting people from all different places, you now have a bigger understanding at 18 years old what the world is and where you want to be. And I think that getting that experience at such a young age for me really helped me just cut through the fat of what I want to be doing with my life and saying there's just so much more out there than maybe the small town that you come from.
Oh, absolutely. And something else about the military that's really unique because of that is that these girls, they come from all walks of life, all like income levels, all family backgrounds, right? So even if you go to college, you're not going to even get that same diversity. No. As you get there. So, I mean, it's just, it's like you said, it's like the most beautiful melting pot to learn about the world and to broaden your perspective, like right instantly, right as soon as you get to boot camp. Because you go through that first week, it's hell, and you do it together.
It is. And they assign your battle buddy and you don't even know them. So the relationships that I had, I didn't even know those people. And I would say, you know, get a battle buddy, whatever place you're at in any service, make sure you have someone that you're accountable to that has the same service as you, because that has changed me. I always have a guidepost. I can always go back. I mean, the conversations we had, you can build a life on. You could write a million books. But like I learned from my friend who was in the Navajo that there was only two ways out: basketball scholarship or joining the military. That was like what her narrative was, like what her worldview was. There was only two options for her. And there was just so much things that I had never heard about, that I had never known about. And so when I see stories about things, I'm like, oh, you have no idea. You know, all of a sudden I take umbrage because I know a little bit about just the people I've served with. And in some ways, it's like, if that's like your only way out, like I had the benefit of saying, you know, I want college money, and we weren't coming up from any amount of real money, but that didn't matter because I still had a better starting place, right? Like I had a choice. It wasn't basketball, or my dad would have been happy about that, but it wasn't basketball or the military to get out of maybe like a bad situation. Right. I had tons of options, and then you come, there's just such love and community and family that comes from different places around this country. And I got to experience that through my friends and the letters that their parents would write and all the hilarious stuff that would come. And like, they really, really, this was everything for all of us. And just growing up that way together, what a great, you know, message for the Army. Really, I mean, truly, this is why diversity actually works. The military is the best example of that, because none of any of the things you think matter at all, you're in here to get this job done. You're in here to get the mission done. And anybody can set all that aside, and now you're in the foxhole together. And now you may not even like that person. You would have never made friends with that person. And now you're in it together, and you would do anything for them. You would die for them. You would be in that with them. And that like quickly makes you realize they signed the same pledge as you, right? Like they said that I would give everything for this country, and they did, and they walked the walk. So the people that you serve with, and I know I might offend people who are not veterans or didn't serve, but they've already taken that initial like step up in my mind of like who they are as a person. Like just because they served. And there's bad and good in all walks of life, but there's just like one tranche that they went up. So as soon as I see a female veteran, I'm like screaming, like the unicorn. I never see unicorns in the wild, right? Like, I'm so excited to see you, right? And it doesn't matter what branch or what service, because I already know they already had to do so much more than the average person. Absolutely. Just to be in that situation. So
I have yet to meet a female veteran, and you know, I talk to many. Yeah, some of them don't even come on the show, but we still have conversations and everything. And wow, I have not met one who does not feel that way.
Like, yeah, I mean,
we just always love to connect with each other, no matter what.
Yes, and a lot of people don't ever bring it up. So many times, I'm surprised by someone coming to me and telling me, like, "Oh, actually," and you're like, "What?" Like, it's a surprise to them that they even have a place to talk about it. And just with my career recently in the book, now I'm out there more and I'm meeting more of them from all different branches. And to me, we're hugging. I mean, pre-COVID, we're hugging and crying. And I just met this person and they're telling me their most intimate service stories that they want me to tell.
It's beautiful.
And you're like, where does that relationship exist in other parts? I mean, maybe with like people that work in the hospital or in medical field or law enforcement, or those things that are similar. But usually that's like on a local level. This is like a global level. You're doing those things in a global setting. So it's even more heightened in some cases. It's not your neighbor that you're helping. It's like someone you would never have any other reason to be there than the fact that you joined the military. So
absolutely. I mean, very well said. So when you left boot camp and you went to AIT, what was that experience transitioning into active service like for you?
So I actually had another year because the school had a wait list. So they always push the National Guard people to the bottom. They're like, yeah, that school will come up, but all the while you're serving. So I went home from basic and all my friends went on to AIT. And so I was like, okay, waiting for my school. The Defense Information School in Fort Meade, Maryland is where I went. What an amazing place. It's essentially taking your university education and distilling it to, I think it was 3 or 4 months of just being a public affairs journalist. So you learn to be a writer, you learn to be an editor, edit your own stuff. Also, like broadcast journalism, like you get a little taste of that, writing press releases and all those things. So photographer, you're everything. And if you're on a ship, because I served with all the branches in my AIT, so I had people that had been in 20 years, and then I had people that were just fresh from whatever basic they'd went to. So we had the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines all training, the Coasties, we had one. And it was an amazing experience to learn the thing I'd loved in high school and to be immediately learning to be a professional in it. And I loved Fort Meade. I loved the location of Baltimore, Annapolis, and Washington, D.C. So that transition was like, I'm in a big city, and they let us go out randomly. Like, the drill sergeants would like hide in the bushes and be like, what were you doing? But like, if you were just out on the town and spending all your money on a lobster tail or something, that was pretty much what I was doing at 19 years old. So I'd be like, Dad, I need more money. It's like, isn't the military paying you? It's like, yeah, but it's a little late this month, so I need a little bit more money. So like, I think just because that was so new to me, being in the Northeast and the expense of everything and coming from a small town, it was really cool to be in a bigger city on the weekends when we weren't training. But you know, it also kind of spoiled me for college because I did get my journalism degree. And after that experience, I'd already done so much of what I was learning, and I had to learn it really quickly. They wouldn't let you have an editor. So as a writer, the number one thing is a good book is not written, it's rewritten. Okay. Because you got to iterate. And so as a writer in the military, you may not have someone that has your skill set when you're either deployed or on a ship. You might be the only one. So you have to learn to write and produce and then just put it out there without any feedback. And that's the way they measure you in school. So that was a big moment for me because I had to start to learning all the grammar rules that I was like, oh, that's not really important, you know, tell the story. But the military way of doing that was funny and hilarious because all your instructors are in the military as well. And so you're getting this good dichotomy of like almost a university education, but next to with people in the military. So one of the things I learned as a photographer was the lesson. It was like a Marine guy and he was very gruff, right? So he said, when you take pictures, I don't want to see any chimping. And we're like, what is chimping? And he's like, when you look at the digital part and you're like, ooh, 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 because you're so excited that you're like, look what you took. And then another one was, and if you're, I want you to only use foot zoom. And we're like, foot zoom? What does foot zoom mean? And he just like took his camera and he walked. Like,
military terminology.
He's like, you're not going to use the zoom. You got to walk to your subject and get close to your subject. I don't want to see this back here. And then you zoom in. You need to foot zoom in. And I'm just, there's certain lessons that make it bleed. That was a big one. So when they would, when you would write a story and they would come back with all the edits and they would put it in red ink, everything you did wrong. And the terminology was make it bleed, you know? So it was just like this like super funny, you know, way of learning to write and be a producer at that same time. So.
Well, that sounds awesome. And definitely like military terms. So it's like, yep. What I always tell people, we have our own language. So when you come out of the military and you, like I did, and go into like a corporate environment, which is what I did. And I'm looking around, I'm like, no one understands me. Like no one understands me because I just had my own terminology for everything and that people understood and like none of these people get it. So yeah, I love that. And yeah. It always tickles me to hear that stuff. So what was it like for you as a public relations, like a journalist for the Army?
So you're learning to do all the jobs. And in that you learn to write a press release, write stories, because they don't know exactly what your mission is going to be. I served, you know, and when I was in the Guard, every month we would have drill. So that would mean I usually would try to write a story or edit a story and then give it to our editor who worked full time for the Guard. And it was called the Iowa Militiaman. So I'd be like, oh, I'm going to have an article in. You get to go do every job. So you want to know what it's like to be in the medical field. You want to know what it's like to be in the infantry, cavalry, military police, all that. You go alongside them and you tell their story. So you're not telling the actual story. You're telling the Army story. So they teach you to have these command messages. So as an example, if I want to say that something bad happened, I have to give the facts of it. So let's say someone went into a gym and stole something. So the perpetrator went in, he took the weight bench or something and he walked out with it and it was caught on camera. That's the facts. So I tell you the facts. But then after that, I need to tell you what I want you to hear. I need to divert the subject from what bad thing just happened, right? So then immediately it's, okay, but our first responders were there within 6 seconds or 6 minutes or whatever the time is. And that has never been done before. And thank you so much to our first responders who did that and were able to apprehend the person or something. Or our video footage caught everything on there. So it'll just be a matter of time. Like it's always to reassure to when I was deployed in Kosovo, we had certain command messages that no matter what we said, we had to include. And one of them was to maintain a safe and secure environment. So as a writer, you're like, okay, you're writing a story. And then you're like, I got to say, maintain safe and secure environment, like somewhere in this piece. Like, it's like these themes that no matter what you do, you have to always bring it back to the mission that you have in the Army. So I watch as, you know, they put you on video camera and they ask you to talk about a news story that just happened. And then they question you, like reporters question you and try to throw you off your game. So it was our professors trying to throw you off your game. And they want you to reveal more. And you have to remember all the stuff. Like it was a pink gym bag and the guy was wearing gloves, and you have to remember all these details. And then if they say, so it was a blue gym bag, and then if you're like, yeah, then that's like a point off or whatever. So what I learned was public relations through that, as well as being an actual practical writer, like what is the story, that everything we see is coming from a frame, from a lens. And the Army is creating that lens. And that's what you're doing as a public affairs specialist. You're that frontline person. You know, I did a lot of really positive stories to promote the image of the Army in the places that you're in. And they feel great to do that. And you might be in a Chinook helicopter. My first drill in the Guard, I was in a Chinook helicopter, and they were firing a 50 cal out the window so they could train. So I got to be in all the cool things that I would want to explore as a writer. I get to go alongside them and then tell them what their story is, and highlight the good things that we're doing, and also the stories of the people. So that's very a little cool. bit of it.
Very cool. So how long did you do that for?
I did that my whole career. So it was 6 years, and I had 2 where I was inactive, but 6 years of being a public affairs specialist. So I started at 17, and at 23, I was pretty much done. So.
Wow. I'm still really young. And you got a chance to deploy. So how many deployments did you have?
So in the Guard, prior to my year-long deployment, we went to El Salvador, and we do certain missions. And it can be that there's something that they want done, and it's like a temporary mission. So then they have different units just do that as a temporary mission. So I did that for 3 weeks, and I met, I think we had like 10 or 12 different Latin American countries that came to El Salvador, and it was this awesome event. So I wouldn't call that a deployment, but I'd call that an experience where it wasn't just sitting back at a, you know, a base or something. And then a lot of people, when I joined, they were like, maybe I'll go to Germany, because this is pre September 11th. So my first drill with braces on my teeth, I'm in a Chinook.
Wow.
And they're like, are you going to New York? And I'm like, no, we're not. But you're with the aviation group, so a lot of aviation units were going there. It was a very, I would say, grounding experience, because now you just signed up for 6 years, and you didn't sign up as like the super awesome patriots that joined after September 11th. You joined thinking college money and experience, and now this is really real. And so I think that you, at different times, you're doing missions all over the place. My first deployment that I would say was a year-long deployment, my only one that makes me a veteran, was when we went to Kosovo in 2004 through 2006. It was really just like a year and some months. And we started in Germany and then went to Kosovo. And there's all these other countries that surround that. So then you got to go and do those too. But yeah.
What was that experience like for you?
It was a peacekeeping mission, or peacemakers. That's what we were called. So maybe more onus on us, I guess. That really gave me everything I thought I wanted to have when I set out to join. At 20 years old, I was the editor of our magazine. I would have never got that experience ever unless I was at a student newspaper. But all of our articles were picked up by other, like the AP Press, or, you know, that any of those press release agencies could pick ours up, because anything I would have made in the military is access to the public, because it's taxpayer dollars that fund us. So anybody can run my story. So I was in the Jewish New York Times. That was like this awesome thing. Like, you could Google yourself and you're like all over the world and your articles all over. And they're telling what the story was, and you have pictures and all that. But I really got to do what I set out to do. It was also being away from your family for a year. So a lot of people understand that that can put something on you. I'm really glad I did it young. The people who had kids and everything like that, it was a lot more difficult. I met 33 other nations. We were there serving with them. So every country you could ever want to visit or learn about, I got to meet their soldiers and work with them and do missions and do stories about them. So because it was multinational, we were there with NATO. You really get to see what our partnerships and our international organizations abroad are doing, like everything. There was the UN with a mission specifically. So you get to meet all those people and feel like you're working towards something while learning this other culture. So Eastern Europe, what's really sad is I would say, hey, I was deployed to Kosovo, and people back in the US would say, is Kosovo a city in Iraq? Or like, no. No, yeah. It's in Eastern Europe. We're in hundreds of countries. I mean, we have so many missions that people don't know about, and they couldn't even pronounce the name if they ever heard of them. But our service members are everywhere. And in Kosovo, that was absolutely on the spotlight. You have so much to do and to highlight and to work towards. In 2005, it wasn't even a country. So today, Kosovo is a country. When we were there, it was still coming off a few years of the war. And so it was a very different experience. They, a secular Muslim country, loved Americans. And on September 11th, they would cry with us. They would have candlelight vigils. And that is a totally different experience than what people expect. And it was the Serbian Christians who were at like a nationalistic attitude towards some of those countries. So we went into Serbian villages, and we went in like Kosovo Serbian villages and Kosovo Albanian villages. And so you'd know you were in a Serbian village because there would be a pig. But like in the Kosovo Albanian, where they were Muslim, they wouldn't be. And I mean, the way we intervened, for people who don't know, is Milosevic was killing his own people. And that... Yeah, so it was something where there isn't a clear line of resources they needed or oil or anything, right? So they went in just for a humanitarian mission to say it's not right to have genocide happen in 2001, right? So I think for me, I took some college classes at night when I was there. So I got to meet Eastern European professors who worked for Radio Free Europe. And they're like 80 years old. I can still remember them like with the beret. Like I just... There's these people that you would never, ever get to meet. And it was such an amazing experience to see the world in an international setting with international organizations working hard, and then meeting the people that you were serving. So who are you keeping the peace for? I mean, their stories truly stay with me. Their pictures I took, I have thousands of pictures I've taken as a photographer there. And it's just like in their eyes, like what they've went through and what their world is. And I personally, like when I left Kosovo, and we can talk more about that, but I still have friends. Like my translator is still my friend. I mean, my people, they're still your people. You build this bond with your translators. You are sharing their world and their life. And so all these news articles become absolutely totally real for you. And you are seeking more information as someone who's served in that environment. You want to be educated. I got, you know, a whole semester's worth of courses done in Kosovo because I now, with no distractions and no, I would say, less comforts that are available to you in Kosovo, you're able to really see what are you made of? What's your day going to be? Are you going to get up at 6 a.m, go into an office, go on a Chinook, go in an Apache, go into all these other different types of aviation platforms, come back after a day, write your story, then go to the gym, teach aerobics, because I was that weirdo doing that too, and then go to class from 6 to 10, and then repeat. And then having like the JAG be your professor in psychology. You know, like you have this amazing realization that your day is what you make it. And partying and all the stuff that young people are really into, that's not the most important thing. It doesn't have to be. You can do so much more with your day. And something else that kind of stuck with me was there was a cafe there. And so there was no alcohol that you could partake in Kosovo. So all these people who were used to doing that in the States would hang out at the coffee bar. And so they're all jittery, but it's from the coffee now because they're having like 3 or 4 cappuccinos. And you're like, this is hilarious. It's like a lens of life, right? To see when you're taken out of your element What are you made of? Being a leader, I went to primary leadership development school there. So I really felt like at 20 and 21, I had set a bar so high for myself about what I could accomplish that I've always been competing with my own self since then. It was a really great experience, the worst of times and the best of times.
Beautiful. Oh, I kind of shed a tear about that Kosovo story there. This is beautiful. Good. My next question for you is, it sounds like you had such an incredible, incredible experience. But what I want to know is, I guess, what was the greatest obstacle you faced while you were serving? Just to balance it out. Were there any?
Absolutely. So I thought about this question because I know that the obstacles that so many people have are very different and varied. And so I want to acknowledge that my experience is, I really think I was lucky in so many of those things. But in general, I'll say that the biggest obstacle I had to overcome was myself. Everything that you think happened, happened to me, I would say, meaning discrimination and harassment and all the stuff that we hear as female veterans, because we were at the time 11% of the force. And there's just so much that isn't built for us. They weren't ready sometimes, I think, when they put you in different situations and you are the only female in the room and they don't know how to lead you. And it's not that it's that different, but they don't even know how to think for just a moment that you are the only person like you in that room and you are representing for so many other things. And so when they make that joke or they belittle you or they talk over you or you say something intelligent and the next guy says the same thing and they're like, way to go to that guy when you just said the exact same thing before. Everything in a corporate culture that, you know, people think about that they're trying to get people up the ranks. It's like the military shouldn't have that because it is one of the first times where if you're good, you're good. If you pass basic, you're moving on. If you meet the standard, you are moving on. Correct. Right. Mm-hmm. But then there's all the stuff that you have to do to get to that point that your starting line is not the same. Right. I wasn't able to do push-ups easily. So just as a really minute example, I had to work even 2 or 3 times harder than maybe the average guy. And even though that's something small, that's my experience. So when someone says women cannot do X, Y, or Z, or they really don't want you there because they want to be free to do whatever weird stuff or say whatever jokes they want to say or watch videos that they want to watch. They don't want you there in a lot of cases. And you join something knowing you would be the minority of that percentage, like you're 11%. And that feeling never leaves you. It's always clouding your judgment about, did he say that to me because of this? I always say, and I wrote about this, you can only really be, if you're nice, they're going to think that you want them. If you are mean, if you're a bitch, then they're going to respect you or they're going to talk about you as a bitch. Mm-hmm. But then they're going to say, but it's just easier. So do you want to deal with a weirdo following you after your meal? Or do you want to just be like, no, screw you. And then you can go about your day. Right. Mm-hmm. So you don't get to be all the layers that feminine, you know, energy brings out. You don't get to bring your whole self to work. You have to bring a version of yourself that's hardened for the fight to just sit there and be there every single moment. And when other people are promoted above you, when other people are, their career goes further than you and you're really at a loss for what it is about you that you could possibly do. So I had to look internally because if I was able, and I want to say, get past the endurance, because a lot of people just endure. Right? You have to move past that. It is so hard psychologically to prepare yourself in that way and then perform at your best. And so we had to find a balance. And there's so much, it's like what cognitive dissonance, where the lie you tell yourself to get through it so that you can say, I got to be a part of this really great thing, right? And there's other things that shaped who I am, but I guess I really had to look at myself in the eye and say, are you going to cry? Because eight men just said, like grown men just lied to your face about something they said to the commander. Are you going to go cry about that? And in my heart, you know, you're 20 and 21, and I can remember being on a phone and calling my family, and you know, you're saying it out loud, but they can't even help you because they don't even know what you're going through. They've never been through that. They don't understand. You can take off the uniform and go to sleep, but it's never over. They could wake you up in the middle of the night and start the fresh hell all over again. And knowing that women are so few and far between, we really cling to each other because no one, unless you've been through that experience, understands. And even then, they may not agree. Because it's like, you know, there's all different types of experiences. And I really thought about all the little incidences that happened or all the things, the slights, the big events. I was in a car accident when I was in Kosovo while we were on duty. Those huge, you know, physical things where you really confronted life and you didn't know if you'd walk away or not. Like, so I've thought about those things, and I still think the biggest obstacle I had to overcome was myself. You can tell I like to talk. So I love to argue. And so when something wasn't right, I wanted to argue it the whole way. And I had to learn to choose my battles. But that's not fun when you're right and you know it.
It's hard.
And that you're sitting there like a six-year-old guy lying. Like, I just feel like you face humanity in a very real way, and it's 24 hours a day, and you can't take it off. You're in that, right? So that was something that weighed on me for a long time, but then I realized it really set me up. I wanted experience, right? You want to know what it's like in the real world? Here's this times 10, and you can't leave. So what are you going to do? And how is our diamonds going to be shaped by the fire, right? Under pressure. So now I'm very relaxed and chilled out about a lot of things because I think, this is like the greatest day of all because I didn't have to do all of those other things that would have been my worst day, right? In the military. Am I free? I get a sunburn. Am I in trouble? Like, is, you know, like all the little things that we think about as government property. I mean, you realize what you're made of, and no leadership school on the planet, no book you're going to read is ever going to teach you that. You're going to be tested in every way. And that is incredibly empowering for the rest of your life, but it's real, people. And the people who think we had it easier some way, they have no idea where we started from. And what we had to do, you know, I think there was like a saying our former president said, like, I don't know, twice as hard and back in heels or backwards in heels. And I always think about that, where you're balancing who you are as a woman with this absolute drive to be a warrior and a soldier and to meet it, to meet the moment and to be an asset. And then you're viewed because of your gender, no matter what you do, you always doubt, did I really do that well? Or did I do that well for a female? So yeah, that was my biggest obstacle. That was quite a bit, but.
No, I mean, I totally feel you. I think we all feel you on everything that you said, because I always say, I've said a million times that, you know, I had an amazing, amazing military experience until the day that I didn't, right? And even after that, I survived it, because what are you going to do? You are property. You're property of the United States government. And so you only have two choices, sink or swim, right? And the sink is not really an option. So you have to swim, right?
No.
So no. You do what you have to do and you get through it. And you know what? It makes you stronger. It makes you stronger for it. We're cut from a different cloth, those of us who have had this experience and we've come out of the other end of it. And I always say this too, I don't know anyone, not one person that I have met that has not at least witnessed some type of, you know, misogyny, racism, harassment, bullying, that includes hazing of some sort, or, you know, rape, something yes. that you're aware of it has happened to someone or witnessed it yourself, right? Having served in the military. And that I would consider the dark side of serving, right? But there's so much, like from your beautiful story, there is so much you can gain from serving as well. So what I love about this podcast, especially, is for younger women who are like the age you were when you were going in, who are thinking about going into the military, they can hear these stories now. They're there for them so that they can make the decision of, do they want to do this or do they not want to do this? There's all these benefits. There are some drawbacks. There can be. Some people, they go through it and they're unaffected, right? You know, I've had guests tell me, you know what? Yeah, there was harassment. There was this, there was that. But you know what? It didn't really faze me. It didn't, you know, I just kept pushing through, you know, or I have had other certain guests, like I recognized immediately the gender difference, right? Like you said, it's not really set up for us, right? So, or they're still trying to set it up for us, I suppose. And so I had to do everything that the guys did, but I had to do it better. I had to like constantly yeah. prove myself. So it's like really a lot of what you're saying is, you know, we have to push and we have to fight and we have to go through these things to get what we need done at the end of the day, because you take the uniform off, but you can't take off the fact that you're property of the United States government. And you have all these different personalities, good and bad, around you that you have to deal with, some in leadership positions, some your peers, but you have to deal with them. Like the guy's lying and you know they're lying, or you want to, you know what I mean? You have to deal with yeah. the guy and he's making this joke and you don't know if you should be like, dude, shut up. That was inappropriate. Or if you should just stay quiet because is it worth it? Like you're always like weighing yeah. out, do yeah. I want to be the bitch? Or like you said, do I need to tell this guy off to stop following me around and asking me out and let me be? Or is it just worth it to just kind of ignore him and just deal with it? You know what I mean? Like these decisions yeah. that we have to make moment to moment as a female serving in the military. But at the same time, that's set right against the fact that you're having this incredible experience, yeah. learning everything you needed to learn, you know, living this best life where you set the bar really high for yourself and just having this kind of all around incredible experience. But then you do kind of have this as a little shadow going on during yeah. this time period. So,
and it's like, you know, my sister is still serving and she's been in like over 16 years and there are moments, because she's been deployed a few more times than me, where she'll call and be like, is this worth it? Wow. She's, you know, moving up the ranks. And she's just like, just the everyday pull. And I always say, you have to keep going. If you're in this, you're in this. And while you're in it, be totally there. Because if there's no one else that's going to stick up for us. So I got out. But who's going to lead the next people who decide to get in? And if you're there as a leader, you have to endure so that you can make a better military for our females. And I know that that experience should exist for them. I know that I was made into the person I am because of that. And so if there was someone like her or with her foresight, I mean, females do a lot of things better in the military than men. Better. When you bring a female into a very tense situation, they can talk them down. They're never going to try to use their body as like a force. It's never going to be a physical fight. They're always going to come with a little bit more of a calming presence, and they're going to de-escalate the situation. So a female being in that place should be there. We've proven it, right? It's even better. It gets better. The mission's easier. You should use our skills. And so to always just be fighting against like the veneer of who you are while you're trying to perform one of maybe the toughest missions of your life, you have to think like, why? But there is a deeper why. So find out what your why is, why you're there. And I think that for the people who are still serving and maybe listening, like you are the change, you know, you are the ones I want to see, the ones I want to know exist. And when you ask yourself, like, who are your heroes? I don't have to think for a second that it's not them right now. And my book was dedicated to those in harm's way because they're in it right now. They're the Absolutely. Ones calling and crying home right now. And so you are not only as equal, you're better in many cases. So find out what those are and hold on to them. And we deserve to be there and absolutely be respected as members of the team, if not equal, even leading, right? So
absolutely. Well, what's that quote? There's nowhere where big things are being decided that a woman shouldn't be, right? Or big things
yep, absolutely.
Being done.
Yes.
So my next question for you is about your transition out. What was that like for you when once you decided it was time to leave the Army National Guard?
So it's a little bit different in the Guard because you are serving after my deployment. You're kind of waiting to get deployed again because at that time it was 2006, 2007. It's still like the prime season where the Guard is still holding up all these deployments. So a lot of people assume that because you're in the Guard, it's less of a service. It's similar, but they're deploying more Guard in some cases because they have a certain skill set. So like if they really need military police and everyone's busy on the main bases, they have a military police unit in the Guard. And so they're going to deploy them even to maintain some of the people that you need to rest back in the regular military. And we're civilian like service members. So we have a lot of people have jobs that are very interesting, like high powered lawyers, and then they're in the JAG. Or they're a doctor and then they happen to volunteer for a 4-month stint on a deployment. So they're already in the field. I remember there was like a video game designer and he was just doing it for fun, like, cause he had all these degrees and he was like, let's do this. And so you have a lot of really interesting, cool people. I was deployed with the California Guard and all that. So you have who you are in the military and then you have your normal, whatever life that was. And I was going to the university. So my transition was easier to the sense that I didn't have to really change where I lived or my day to day. I still had something to come back to because I'd been building it the whole way. I do think coming back from Kosovo was a much bigger jump. So coming back from active duty after over a year and jumping right into the college courses at the University of Iowa. It was like when the Razor was a really big phone. And I remember people caring so much about having the latest and greatest stuff. And I had just saw the people in Kosovo, or I had seen all of these issues that were so much bigger to me, that international humanitarian rights, they were still searching for the people who slaughtered innocent civilians. And the governments were hiding it at the time. And so I'm at college and they're giving a lecture and I'm thinking of Mladic and Karadzic and thinking like these bastards, right? Like you have to find them. And I know they're on government payrolls and like you have all this information that's more than a news story to you. So I was taking it very seriously. I was not out partying. I was not enjoying whatever college life people would think would be important to me. It just wasn't important to me at all. It made me angry that people didn't understand service. I was upset that they could nonchalantly not care about what was happening around the world. And it was just another, you know, news headline to them. And the university environment, you have a lot of really interesting conversations in your classes and your lectures. And so you're able to have this free moment where people let their guard down and then you hear what people think. And you're just sitting there like, you have no idea. You want to shake them, right? Out of their yeah. complacency, out of their ignorance. Your innocence is gone about the world and what it's made up of and what people can do to other people. You've saw the worst of people. And you now realize that mommy and daddy are paying for all these college students to not care, to not show up. And you put your life on the line to get your college paid for. This is very personal to you.
I feel
and you're sitting there watching people not care and not have any regard for the world we live in. And they're like, this is the greatest country on earth. And you're like, really? By what metric? Because in some cases, you see that people are people everywhere. and they just want to have a job to feed their family. They want to be free from war. I mean, it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean, like, they have to have like so many things met, their basic things met, before they could ever dream of the things that we would have. And that transition was hard, and it was blunted by my friends in the military, my battle buddies, the organization. I had some really good veterans that came and worked for our university. So they were actually veterans that could help you get your benefits and all that. Mm-hmm. They really helped. And then I met people. One of my best friends was from Bosnia. She came up to me and she was like, what are you? Like, where did you come from? And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, you are just arguing passionately about Milosevic. And I was like, yeah. And I was like, where are you from? And she was from Srebrenica. Srebrenica was home to one of the worst massacres of men and boys on a football field in Bosnia. So we connected. Her and her sisters were hiding in the bushes from Serbian people who were murdering civilians. It was so horrible to meet in this environment. Like, kind of, you see the results of that. And now you're not just in your soldier mindset, you're in your human mindset. And I mean, she still has shrapnel in her head from what happened. So it's a very real, visceral experience. So college was me finding people like that. So I met people that had a lot of internationals, actually. I took even more courses. I got a second major in international politics just because I wanted to, not because I needed it. And that really informed me and my writing. And it helped me understand, what was that experience? What did you just do? You just spent a year of your life in this country, and what did it mean? Right. So that was my transition. And it was, you know, a lot of angry, you don't understand moments. And then there was this freedom of like, okay, so what do I do now? Like, I wanted to get out because I wanted to see if I could make it in the world as a writer without the benefit of always being published, because it was my job. I mean, the military provides that platform that whether you're good or not good, you're going to get published. Like, if you wrote right. The chow hall menu, or if you wrote this compelling story about like leadership, I mean, you're going to get published either way. But I wanted to see if I could make it. And you really fall flat because they don't care. When I came out, they didn't care that I was a veteran. I got a job at a call center after getting my degree, just like I could have had when I was 16. So they didn't care that I was a veteran. They didn't care that I had my degree. The 2008 crisis was happening, and no one cared about whatever you thought was so important. All that experience doesn't matter. Hey, how about we pay you almost half of what you made in the military? Wouldn't that be fun? For you to try to budget against something, and then now you're not even making it, and you're doing everything you can, working two or three jobs, hoping that someone's going to care. And in that moment, you realize like, you can only rely on yourself and all the lessons that you learned. Now they got to get really, you got to put them into play, because there's no one that's going to come rescue you. There's no money train that's going to happen. And when they propose a lower salary to you, when they're paying interns more, you have to ask, like, we say they care about veteran experience, but put your money where your mouth is, because I didn't see that.
Yes.
And where is it? And it isn't, people have said, like, so, you know, why is it? I think they even shied away from us because of maybe people coming back with the horrors of war. Right.
Yes.
And so they were scared about that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to say, if they're there and they've persevered, how are they not the top of your list? Right.
I mean, thank you. Thank you. Because I
you
feel
should
like
be
that.
Begging to hire a veteran. Like, it's insane to me. And you know why? I think, you know, in my experience, it's because they know that they didn't serve. And they don't understand that service, and they're too scared to ask the questions. And so HR people have to get real. They have to start educating themselves and say, actually, I know, because I mean, I tried for so long to get hired. I tried for years I had already been an editor. I had Jewish New York Times. I had broadcast videos that I had so much experience and here you go. And guess what? They don't even open it. They don't even care. So
wow.
I guess there's a lot of jobs like that. I always felt that men, like if you had a technical something, my mom's a nurse. So if you were a medic, you have a technical thing that can easily be transitioned if you keep going, right? If you're in an aviation world and you're a maintenance person, you can easily keep going and use that. But there's a lot of other jobs that aren't necessarily transitioned exactly. I thought being a public affairs would transition very easily in marketing and in journalism and all of that. And, you know, they care more about where I went to high school than what I just did for 6 years. And that to me is, how do we take all this breadth and beauty of an experience and make it relevant? Because when I was getting up for drill and it was 4 a.m. and I had to drive for 2 hours and my roommate is partying and I told him not to have a party on this night because I have to get up and drive. And I get up and I go serve that whole weekend. I get up at 4 a.m. and I didn't party like that. That wasn't my college experience. I was working and serving. And so my thing is, where does that ever matter? Like it doesn't. And so when they're like, oh, well, I had an internship. Well, my internship was 6 years. Okay. And I still didn't make what the interns would make. Like to me, and I thought initially, Kia, that that was like a unique experience to me. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I was super pissed all on my own. Mm-hmm. And then with my book, I started meeting veterans and other female veterans. And then my friends that are in awesome careers now and doing all sorts of great things with their experience, they say the same thing. And I'm like, what? Like,
yes.
Like I was like, what? They offered you like 30K after you made double that, like with 15 years of experience.
Yes. Oh, it's so common.
And like that adds up to $14-$15 an hour, which is what you could make if you worked in that call center in different areas. Like I made like $9 an hour and I forewent healthcare insurance so that I could get an extra $2. It's like, that's what we come back to.
That's the choice. Oh my God. So I don't believe, everybody knows this, I don't believe you should deploy or serve in general and then come out of the military or come home, right, to the country that you just became property for. You gave up your human rights, right? You come back and you can't have your basic needs met, so you end up homeless. And equally as bad is you come back and you can't find a job or no one will hire you, or when you do find a job, you're making slightly above minimum wage and you have to choose between healthcare and $2.
And even with like the VA, that was such a different experience. I mean, I think they're getting a lot better. And I'm someone who says, go to the VA and push them in every sense of the word for the right care. Push the system to learn how to take care of you. If you have the benefit of private insurance and you can afford private doctors, and then you go do that, but they never learn how to care for you. Like they need to know that female veterans have a different sort of care that needs to be provided. And we need to hold up for our female veterans who can't, the ones who did come back and they're not completely whole and they might not show up to work and they may not have that drive and they may say it's not worth it. So we have to do what we can because they cannot. And that's the battle buddy scenario I brought up earlier. Mm-hmm. You have to be accountable to other people and raise their stakes while you're raising yours. And when you walk through the door as a female veteran, you need to hold it open for those that come behind you, because that's so critically important. If you just fought like hell to get through there, what are they going to have to do? Because it's not linear. It's not like immediately like, oh, so like we have this like female veteran candidate. So like we just check that diversity box in our corporate lingo, right? But what do we actually do? Right.
Absolutely.
Like, and were they ready for her? Were they ready for someone like me who's very direct, who's very honest, who isn't going to back down? Right. And in some cases, like I've heard other female veterans tell me that they weren't promoted and they were told that because they were too just out there, like too direct.
Well, they're aggressive, right?
Aggressive.
You love that word.
They're almost masculine.
Right. They're too masculine, like, too tough, too bitchy. That's another one that female veterans get a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you should be so lucky. Have you never had a healthy debate? Because if you want to grow, if you want to make more money in any business, you want to grow your business, you better have a healthy debate. And only through the friction of that can you find a new path forward, right? And that is something that a different perspective can bring. It's not going to bring everybody up. You can't hire one person and then everybody just starts to act right and think out of their own experience. Like, they have to be ready, and the candidate has to be ready, and everybody has to be ready to be like, let's go create something new and different. And there should be more veterans at the table. And when there are, it makes a difference.
I agree.
Meeting your deadlines, you're meeting the moment, you're meeting whatever they asked you to do, and you're doing it and you're happy because they know what it could be. They know it could be 24 hours and they wouldn't be able to go home and see their family. And so this is actually like easy for us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I served before you. So I was out, I finished my inactive reserve just before 9/11 happened, like just before. And even for me though, coming out, having have served during peacetime. So there was no, I mean, I'm a combat veteran as far as Desert Storm, but I went in at the very end. They were already starting to bring people home, right? So essentially, my service was during peacetime. And even then, coming out of the military, there was a period of time where I could not put that I was a veteran on my resume. It took me forever to figure out, why am I not getting hired? Like, you know, my resume is fantastic. Like, why am I not? I have all these amazing skills. Why am I not getting hired? And I just took it off. Someone suggested, they were like, well, why don't you take being a veteran off your resume? And I was like, why? Remember, I was in Arizona at the time. And I was like, why? Like, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And I tried it and it worked. I got a call the next day, the very next resume I sent off. And then I got a bunch of calls after that. I could not believe it. And I was like really thrown through a loop, because I was like, well, why would it be a bad thing for me to take that off my resume? And then another interesting thing happened. So I go by Kia because my full name is Zakiya and it has a Z in it. And that tends to throw people off my whole life, right? But it's also a Muslim name. Okay. And so my father was very, and he was into Malcolm X and he got into Islam following Malcolm X and the civil rights movement and all of that. He was a huge part of it.
Yeah.
And so I was born and he named me this. Okay. So when 9/11 happened, incidentally, I could not get a job again. And then I had to realize, oh, now I have to start going by Kia on my resume, which is what people called me anyway, but it was just like my nickname, right? So I'm like, oh, I have to go by Kia on my resume also, because now I can't get a job because of that.
Right.
Right. And so both of those things had to go off my resume.
Things that are integral and really personal, your real name. And I mean, that like really hits me, because like, I understand that people, and it's even now in hiring processes for people who are listening and in corporate or any types of hiring activities, you can just, if you believe you are who you say you are and your values, just cut the name and the address off the top and then have some, you know, just write the number like 123 and then you write them on the back. And then once you've decided, you can go find out where they live or their email or whatever you need to know of who you picked, right? But like, really do a blind look. And don't look at those names, because that has nothing to do with it. As soon as you do that, you start to get real, real quick. And I think that is so like sad to me about the name thing, but I've had that with a lot of people that I know, like other veterans have talked to me about just anything to do with the hiring practices and anything to do with being, I believe, unfairly tasked with that, or their language isn't correct. I mean, I remember I've saw people who, I can do resumes and fix resumes, you know, as a writer, people just like, can you just check this for me? You know? And so you're like, sure. But I remember one of my cousins has like a 9-page resume and he paid someone and you're like, what are you doing? But it's all this naval, like really, really awesome, like schools and like certifications and all that. That's all incredibly valuable information. But I know as someone, they don't care. You want to get a job, they do not care. You have to just like become a blank sheet of whatever that job thing was, reflect it back to them so they can think they made the good choice in Word, and it's a computer, right? But anything that actually has to do with who you are as a person was removed from your resume. And that's sad. That's really sad, because I have to ask, you know, I've actually asked people like why they didn't hire me, because I've applied at different positions or all that. And it's always they hired someone, other candidate, some other person or something. But you have to say, like, we have veterans preference for a reason. We really shouldn't need it, because it should already be a bonus. Like, in my mind, if I know someone would lay their life down to do a job, that's like plus 10 right away. Because they're going to work, they're going to bleed. Like, they're going to work for your company or your business or whatever project harder than you've ever saw someone work, because they don't know any different. Right. And I know I'm being broad there, but it's 24 hours, right? So when you go to whatever time period you're going to need them to work, like, they're going to keep going, because it's muscle memory to them. They're going to know how to do that and continue that. So you really, I mean, I'm just kind of trying to promote anyone that's in a hiring position. And if you're a female veteran, you better be looking for female veterans to hire when something comes up. And you might have to do a little bit of extra research, but can you imagine? You just got a unicorn on your team, right? We're so few and far between.
I mean,
wow.
And yeah. Not to mention that it doesn't matter pretty much what your rank is. You get leadership skills in the military. You leave with leadership skills. You are mission oriented. You understand how to work towards the mission for the greater good. You're a team player. Like, there's an endless list of benefits to the skills you got. Even if you had a horrible military experience, by virtue of having been in for any length of time, you walk away with some skills that the average person does not have, period.
I heard a figure that basic was like 100K. Per person, like if they really looked at the money it takes to send someone through, I think it was Army Basic, and it could be an old stat, but it was like 100K per person. I think fighter jets, we realize, are like $1 million, like fighter pilots or something. They've invested in us. So you got a 100K investment, all right? At least, probably more. So what are you going to do with that investment? If you think about how expensive college is, if you have college, I have 2 master's degrees. So if I have that experience plus my military, it should be like a no-brainer, right? Mm-hmm. But like you've always said, you might have to just do it yourself, because nobody is going to come over and be like, you're amazing, let me just help you up this ladder. You know, it's going to be like
kick them doors
fighting
down.
Tooth and nail, right? Yeah. Yeah. Kick it down and then bring your crew in from the back, because you got to represent for everyone that came before you and after you. You have to. But, and it's also servant leadership. So I wish people would talk about that more, that veterans understand servant leadership, that it's not all about them. So as an example, I met a general who, we had like a Christmas dinner or something, and there was a bunch of shrimp cocktail. So I was like, hey, sir, do you want to cut in front and like, you know, get ahead of me? Because there's going to be no shrimp cocktail by the time you're served. And he said, absolutely not. This is for you guys. This is dinner is for you. And I'll eat whatever's left if I do. And it's not important. And it just struck me so many times when our drill sergeants were like tearing us down and building us back up, that they were the ones crying with tears in their eyes that I passed my push-up test, right? She was from Trinidad and Tobago, my drill sergeant. And she was like crying. And she was so mean to me every single day, like every single moment. And that was my person. That was the person that was, they wouldn't even let her test me because we were so linked at that moment. Like they had to have someone else. And so I remember I started with like an 18-minute mile and I got 14-minute mile by the end because the guy said girls couldn't run fast as guys. So I really pushed myself to meet whatever thing they thought. And by doing that, you learn, you know, how far you can go, but also how far you as a servant, and when I'm leading someone, it's not about me. What a gift they have. Like a leader really doesn't have that much control. It's really the people that they're leading have the most control, if you really think about it, because if they don't perform, the leader has to, you know, step in and perform their job for them. So you really should look at it like you are in the lower position as the leader, and the people that you are leading are everything that will make success. Your success is their success, and you don't get success if they're not successful, and you can't claim it. Even if they promote you into oblivion, they might promote you to get you away from them. So promotions don't mean anything. It's like at any level. I mean, I was a specialist when I got out, but I went through primary leadership development school, and none of those certifications mattered when it comes to, are you taking care of someone other than yourself? Are you going to consider someone? Are you going to help them? Are you going to get them on the right path? I mean, you can be a leader at any single step. And servant leadership, write that down. Because when they're saying, have you read Crucial Conversations? Have you read Lean In? No, I haven't. I know what they're about, but those are not my books. Okay. Because I already had the FM manual that showed me how to be, and it was enough. Right. And you guys should be looking at that.
Right. Maybe you should have a look at that one.
Exactly. Like, exactly.
Oh my gosh, girl. I could talk about this with you for like another 2 hours because you are absolutely speaking my language. But I want to talk about how you got to your book and what the journey was for that.
So I talked a lot about, you know, what I encountered or felt in the military. And I also knew that being a writer was really important to me, and no one was going to help me do that. So the writers I like to read were older than me. They were like 60-year-old women and men, thriller writers. And you read all the time when you're in the military, because there might be nothing else to do. And there, you might just be picking up books like left and right. And that's always been something that's important to me. Before I was a writer, I was a reader. And that's number one. I didn't see any books about us. Where's my book? Where's that book? Where's the girl that's not tacitly put in by a civilian? That's like some buxom, like, you know, female veteran that comes straight from the war, and now she's needs a romance. I mean, no, I don't hate on any genres, but there, I had only saw female veterans or had seen female veterans in certain things that they were not real at all, and the details didn't ring true. It was hard for me because we should be the ones that, just like all the lady detectives, how many are there? They've been represented clearly because that's a big part of being a thriller writer. So I just wondered where we were. I also had all this experience that I really didn't get to use because I wasn't given opportunities and jobs that would help me showcase my best self. There's no books that you want to read about your experience, and you're not getting the opportunities you need. Well, you need to work your day job and get at it at night, which is what I did. And so over 10 years ago, I started writing my first novel, Squared Away, and it's about two female battle buddies, and they meet in basic training, and then one of them goes missing. And what would you not do to find your female battle buddy? You would do anything. You would move hell and earth to find who this is. And it allowed me to use some of my experience, infuse it into a fictional narrative, allow people to be entertained while they're learning about who we are, right? Where some of the details should ring true, and then have a satisfactory or some sort of an ending that they've learned along the way, but it's also like a normal journey thriller book. So it was about thriller and friendship. And so that was, I wrote it 10 years ago and no one cared to publish it. Surprise, it didn't resonate. And I thought my marketing language was good because I'm like, look at all these millions of female veterans. Like, this is my target audience, right? But they're not ready. They weren't ready. And meaning I also had to undergo, well, why did you write the book? So I wrote it because I knew these stories needed to be told and no one cared. So then I had to keep writing other books. And so I just kept writing other books. I wrote the sequel and I wrote a third one. And in the meantime, I got a few degrees, I got more money, and I hired the best editors and the people in the industry who would know how to help me shape it into a off-the-shelf book that it holds true to exactly what I wanted to say. But it's also digestible for anyone who likes this type of genre. And so you invest in yourself. And that's what I did. And my first novel was published a year ago, and the second one will be out next year. So it was, my audiobook was another female veteran, someone I served with in Kosovo, and she approached me because I had her do the, I had female veterans do my reviews because that was the most important thing to me. Yes, other people enjoy this book. It can be for anybody that likes reading, but I needed it to ring true. And so some of those experiences are just like in the descriptions would be for me, like she's sitting in the VA and they're asking if like her grand, she's here to pick up her grandpa. And she's like, no, I'm here for my own care. You know, like
classic,
the basic training shenanigans all the way to, because her friend is missing. And that's something that if it's someone you might know a little bit, fine. But if you've served with that person, it's absolutely true that you would do whatever it takes. So that brought me to my first book, and they were ready. I had a publisher in Austin, Texas, my publicist are in Portland, Oregon. So that's my main team. And then my voice actress was in Minneapolis and my editor is in Atlanta. So I had this global team. The cover designer was in England. So I had like this awesome team of over 10 women who brought this to life. And it's insanely beautiful to bring a book baby into the world. So, and as a female veteran, I'm like all about it with other female veteran authors, because we need to have our stories told, but we need to be the ones writing them. So I'm a reader first, Kia, so get yours going.
Right, for sure. For sure. I have about 30,000 words left, and then it'll be done. The first draft, I free wrote everything. So for those of you that don't remember, don't know what we're talking about, I have been working on a fiction. It got two parts to it. The first part has got 30,000 words left. It's been being free written, so it's a hot mess, but it's the first draft and it'll probably be rewritten 1,000 more times after this one. But the story is coming out. It is fiction, but it is based on true experiences of my time serving during peacetime in the mid 90s as a woman of color in the United States Navy. So yeah. And I do need to finish it, but you all know that I do a lot of things. This podcast is one of them. My other show, Hot Topics Live, the live stream show, is growing as well. And I'm also a success coach at London Real Academy, which Brian Rose, our fearless leader of the academy, he is a famous YouTuber. He is now running for mayor of London. So things are bound to get even more crazy for me and my crew at London Real as we follow this journey with him. So I teach as well. But this podcast, the Female Veterans Podcast, is my labor of love, and it actually really comes first. And so I will get to that book. I will promise you, Alicia, I'm going to finish that book, and then I'm going to be like, please beta read this for me.
Absolutely. And I got to be a part of another, she was in the Navy as a military intelligence, a linguist, and she just published Little Falls. And so we have the same like publicist, and we got to be a part of different things together. But seeing her book, I haven't been that excited to read someone else's book in a very long time, because whatever, like that's enough for me to be like, you know, and it's a thriller, and it's in the main character is a female veteran, and you're just like, you just want to show up and be there, because this, we are us, right? Mm-hmm. They don't understand us necessarily, but we can help them along the way. And I love that you chose fiction, because people have asked, why didn't you choose nonfiction? Well, I was a journalist for so long. I realized I could never tell the story I wanted to write, whether real or fiction. You can entertain people. You know, a lot of people don't care about nonfiction books. They don't care about the news. I've learned that, right? But if I tell them, hey, you can just sit down with your coffee and a warm blankie and read this book, it's less of a, I need to inform you of something. But guess what? You're going to learn some things along the way. So you can sneak in that thing that's happening while they're wrapped up in the narrative, right? So, or the plot.
Absolutely. And so you have inspired me to get back to writing. I have all sorts of these little hobbies and projects that I'm doing. I'm working with my little brother on a screenplay too, about female veterans. And
Get it all in, do all the things.
It's got to all come out because I agree. I'm like, thank God you're kicking down these doors. Thank God you're looking around going, hey, where's the book for us? Oh, it's not there. I'm going to write it. That's what I felt like. Where's the movie for us? Oh, it's not there.
Yes.
Let's start writing it. Right. Like, so, so our stories, they're important and they need to be out there. And this podcast and a handful of other podcasts out there now, since I got started and one before mine, shout out to my girl, Amanda, for a Women of the Military podcast. It's important. It's important. And there's more and more of us every day and we got to keep telling these stories. So.
Absolutely.
Everybody go get her book. It's on Amazon. Where can we find it?
It's on Amazon. It has won a couple of awards. So it won the National Indie Excellence Award for Friendship. It was a finalist. And then it won the Next Generation Indie Book Award in the thriller category. So I had both New York and California based awards recognize the value of a female veteran story. That meant everything. Actually, it meant more than my degrees because it was something that was such a pure labor of love. There's something else that, you know, I had written so much on the computer all day that when I first started it, I was unsure that if I could do it. So I just used legal notepads and started writing on legal notepads. I have a stack of legal notepads because I kept doubting myself that I could do it. And I have this as an example that no matter where you're at or what your resources are, you can always write your story. So now that it's out there and it's at Barnes & Noble and Amazon and my website's Alicia Dill, and that's, you can have all the different ways to get it. To me, it meant more than anything else I'd ever worked on because it was us and it was very difficult to finish, right? A lot of people think they have a book in them and they don't finish. So I always say, please finish at whatever point. And then the awards that it won, if you want like a signed copy of that with those awards, like there's different stuff on them, you can direct message me and I have a form for that. So if you want a signed copy or something, but otherwise Amazon Nook.
I will have that form.
And I have these like golden seals. And I have like a stack of them after you win. And so I just want to like put them all over everything. Like this is approved. This is approved. This is approved. Because when you say award-winning author, that to me meant so much. Because if you think about all the things in my career where they never recognize you after, and you're working at the call center after your degree, after your experience, mm-hmm. and you're like, does anyone think that that mattered? Well, guess what? It does matter. It just might take 15 years.
So. Oh my God, girl. I mean, well, Squared Away sounds awesome. I am super excited to read it. I will have my signed copy and everybody, you guys know that I will put all of the links in the description box of this episode in the show notes, as we call it. And so that you can easily find Alicia and connect with her and get your copy or find it on Amazon. So Barnes & Noble and everywhere you're find books. So with that, I have taken up so much of your time. I have just one more question for you. And that is, what advice would you have for your veteran sisters coming behind you?
So the most important thing is that you find what was valuable to you out of your experience and hold on to that. And celebrate that. There are the worst of times. I've heard stories on this podcast and other friends and people's lives that have been, there's a really sad turn of events that can happen in that. But there's also some really beautiful things that you've talked about, Kia, that can come from our experience. You are a veteran and you are worth it. And no one gets to tell you or measure your experience. Because you did what the military asked you to do and you met that moment. There is no one that can denigrate or belittle or take away anything that you accomplished. Female veterans rarely talk about their experience. And I would encourage you to do that because the only way that we can make change is to have our voices heard. you are such a beautiful part of the fabric of the military, and you deserve every single honor and recognition that is given to every veteran. Do not allow your own self-doubt to hide all the wonderful things about you and your experience. You need to bring that up into the world, into the workplace, and you need to bring your whole self to your life. Remember that the things that have happened to us do not define us. And I would be glad to promote or generate or help you in any way along your journey. I truly believe we are all battle buddies, and I really hope to hear from you. And that is just full circle for me. So go out and write your stories and be a part of it and wear your veteran status proudly. And that's my advice.
Oh my God. Such beautiful advice too. I absolutely, absolutely love it. And thank you. Thank you so much for it. Fantastic. And well, thank you, Alicia, yeah. Thank you so much for coming and being a part of the show. It's about that time that we wrap it up. And I know that you said you're on Instagram. Is there anywhere else that we can find you if we want to reach out to you directly?
Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, my website, and Goodreads, and Amazon. If you do buy a book and you liked it, the reviews there are huge. That matters in the algorithms of everything. So if you do enjoy it, or even if you don't, and you want to say your piece, do it. Okay, have your voice heard in every sense of the way. But I think you have all my links and things like that. So
awesome. Again, they'll be in the show notes. And again, I can't tell you what an honor it has been to share this time with you and to hear your stories. It's a privilege to hear them. And it has been an amazing time connecting with you. So thank you so much for coming and being a guest on the Female Veterans Podcast.
Thank you, Kia. Thanks to all the listeners.
And with that, we're going to wrap it up. I want to say to you who have been listening and who keep supporting this podcast that I love you guys. I really, really, really appreciate you and all of the support that you're giving this podcast, and all of you who are coming and want to be guests. I'm truly honored and amazed that we continue to grow together. I appreciate you so much. Thank you for coming on this journey with me. I love you guys, and I'll talk to you next time.